Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Chinese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Sarah Bramau Ramos, and I am one of the hosts here on the channel. And I recently spoke with Ian M. Miller about his new book, Fur and Empire, The Transformation of Forests in Early Modern China. This came out in 2020 with the University of Washington Press. And this is a book I have come to think of as being important for two different reasons. The first has to do with big, narrative-shaping, field-shifting reasons. This book offers a new take on China's early modern forest history, which is traditionally and currently dominated by the narrative of deforestation, the disappearance of China's naturally occurring forests, which, so the standard narrative tells us, led to long-term environmental dysfunction and crisis in the 19th century. This book revises this, revealing instead China's long history of forest oversight. It shows how China developed not European-style forestry bureaus, but instead other institutions with jurisdiction over wood and woodlands. Chinese states may have minimized direct oversight, but the focus on taxing and regulating private commerce in timber led to the rise of timber plantations, which kept forests and various building projects pretty well stocked with trees and timber, at least until novel pressures in the 19th century caused the functioning forest system to collapse. This book then not only calls for a shift in how we view China's environmental history, but also offers a different model of forest management, a non-European model, to global environmental history more broadly. But setting aside these, you know, big narrative-shaping, field-shifting aspects of the book, this book is also really important because it tells the history of China's early modern forest management on the ground, as it were. There are some fascinating chapters in this book that look at what it meant for actual people to work out how to maximize profits and minimize risks and draw up contracts to establish who owned what shares of which forest. And I know, contracts and legal documents might not sound fascinating, but trust me, Ian makes them so. There is another really great chapter that I just want to flag here on imperial logging, and I'll just note here that the lengths that both the imperial center and indigenous and Han groups in border areas went to in order to get large trees, something that we get into in the podcast, are simply mind-boggling. So while this is an important narrative-changing, field-shifting book, the attention paid here to paperwork and bureaucracy and, you know, just the lived experience of those engaged in forest management was a real treat to read and to talk to Ian M. Miller about. And I'll just highlight two things to listen out for as you turn to our conversation: Ian's discussion of what it meant, looked like, and felt to follow a tree through gazetteers, and just how exciting seemingly mundane contracts can be. With that, I hope you enjoy the conversation that follows. I'm here today with Ian M. Miller to talk about his new book, Fur and Empire, The Transformation of Forests in Early Modern China. Welcome to the New Books Network, Ian, and thank you so much for taking the time with all that is going on and all that I'm sure you have going on to talk with me today.
Hi, Sarah. thanks so much for having me. And really, I see this as something of a respite from everything else that's going on. It's always fun to talk about this work.
Glad to hear it. We're going to start, as this podcast usually does, at the beginning, with your beginning. So how did you come to work on early modern China? And with this book in particular, the environmental history of early modern China.
So I guess I came to history and Chinese history and early modern Chinese history all somewhat by accident. I think that my first Chinese history teacher, Lillian Lee at Swarthmore, was really instrumental in guiding me down this path. And I arrived at Harvard for a master's, not 100% sure what I wanted to do, but I ended up liking my history classes and especially my early modern history classes the most. And this project and my interest in environmental history really started with reading The Retreat of the Elephants. And I actually can't remember if I read it for Michael Soni's Late Imperial China class or if I read it sort of on the side, but I ended up getting in a very extended discussion about it with my good friend John Lee. And both of us are still working on these sort of forest projects. He works on Korea. And it just sort of started with that. And I've never really been able to put it down.
Great. So, I mean, I thank you very much for mentioning that work in particular. And I definitely want to come back to not just that work that you mentioned, but, you know, China's in the history of the environmental history of China as a whole. But before we go there, this book, the one we're talking about, For an Empire, comes, as you sort of hinted at there, out of your dissertation work, out of your dissertation project. But of course, this project has changed a lot since it was a dissertation. I went back and had a look at your dissertation, and this book that I have with me here on my desk looks quite different. So can you actually talk a little bit about that process for you of taking your dissertation and turning it into a book? What did that look like, and what was important to you as you shaped that dissertation into the book?
So, as I think I talk a little bit about in the conclusion, actually, I came to this project interested basically in the prehistory of the 19th century social and ecological crises. And so I went into the field sort of interested in studying those, and I had a little bit of a sense that the forest history of China was going to be a little bit different than what I was reading in a European context, but I really didn't know exactly what I was going to find. And I ended up going down a very long and very interesting sort of black hole of lineage studies, which is the core of the dissertation. And the last two chapters of the dissertation are where I really got back to this environmental history piece, which is what I had wanted to talk about. And so then after I graduated, and especially during a postdoc that I did at Yale Agrarian Studies, and also during some time at Max Planck in Berlin, I had some more time to think about it and to really develop the environmental history piece a bit more. And what I realized was that there were really sort of two environmental history stories that I wanted to tell. And one was the story of grave forests, which I have set aside and is probably going to end up being a big piece of my second book. But the other was the story of essentially state forest oversight and commercial forestry, which is what grew into this book. And as you said, you know, there was a lot more work that had to be done on that to turn it into a finished product. And in some ways, the reason that I ended up doing that work first is because I felt like it was an important background that I needed to understand to think about the context around grave forests and forest and sort of like protected forests. But it ended up being much more interesting than just sort of a background to that other study. And in particular, I figured out some things about just how early the development of some of these forestry institutions was, and some really striking contrasts as well as confluences with what's maybe the more familiar story of the development of forestry in early modern Europe and in Japan.
Perfect. So I think you've set us up really nicely there, actually, to talk about the comparative aspects of this book, even really before we get into talking about the main argument. So I think it's worth talking about this here. This book is not an explicitly, or, you know, it's not a comparative study of China and Germany. It's not that kind of comparative work, but it definitely has, and as you've just hinted at, there are comparative elements, because as you point out in the introduction in particular, the European experience is ancestral to our contemporary understandings of forest. And just to, you know, lay out the barest outline of what this European experience looks like, with the huge, huge caveat that you make in the book as well, that there is no single European forestry. The European story of forests is a bureaucratic one, with European states expanding their bureaucracies to oversee domestic forests and colonizing abroad to expand their timber supplies, which looks very different to the Chinese case that you explore in this book. As you say in the book, China did not produce European-style forestry bureaus until the 20th century, although it did develop other institutions with jurisdiction over wood and woodlands. But in thinking about comparison, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. Why did you decide to bring this comparative piece to your book? And what is important for listeners to know about this comparison in order to sort of go further into the book itself?
So I came to do a moderate amount of reading on European forestry in particular to try to better understand what was going on in the Chinese context. One of the patterns that we see in forest history, the historiography, is that there's sort of a first generation of scholarship that's very focused on the deforestation question, much like Mark Elvin's work has been. And when I wanted to get beyond that and away from that, I found myself reading things like Joachim Radkau and Paul Ward and Keiko Madison and some other works on European forestry that were moving beyond the deforestation paradigm. And so that work was very implicit in my understanding. At many stages of the project, I found myself trying to explain why China looked so different. And then at another stage, I guess I realized that in some ways, it was equally important to explain the developments in China on their own terms. So I didn't want to make it explicitly a comparative work, but that comparison was always sort of in the back of my mind. The other thing that occurred to me, especially in conversation with my editors in writing the introduction, is that the European and North American models of forestry, even just that language of forestry, is so much behind our intuitive understandings of what a forest is, what forest oversight should look like, and things like this. And so I realized that a lot of the reason why this story that I told in For an Empire had not been fully told before was that people were overlooking things that were forest administration, that were forms of oversight, because they didn't map directly onto the vocabularies or the institutional mechanisms seen in Europe. And so I had to, I think, for my audience, for the reader, explain that very clearly, because it would help them contextualize the work as well, at least for a readership in Europe or North America.
Absolutely. I love that you said in your answer there that, you know, there were things in China that were forest oversight. I love that you said that just because so much of this book is taken up with detailing what that oversight looks like. And I think that it would be pretty hard to come away having read, you know, some of the the middle chapters of the book, I'm thinking of chapters sort of 2 through 5 here, without noticing that really what you're talking about is forced oversight. We'll get to those chapters in a minute, but there's so much detail there about how forests are being managed and overseen. So thank you for teasing that out a little bit. With that, and with sort of that comparative piece, why don't we move into a little bit further into the book itself? Because Fern Empire, as we've already touched on here, is an environmental history focusing on China's early modern forest history. And I'm not quite sure how you've managed to do this, Ian, but this is a book that is both, sweeping. It stretches from forest oversight in China's early empires, even the Qin and the Han touches on a little bit, all the way to the 19th century. And yet it's also detailed. It delves into, a number of specific moments, people, and texts. It covers things that are quite well known, like Ming shipbuilding and the Zheng He voyages, just to name, one particularly well-known moment. And then some, much less well-known and much more minor, at least in terms of global history, incidences and moments, like minor transactions in forest deeds and wonderfully detailed accounts of the difficulty of imperial logging, just to touch on a few things that I'm hoping we will get into later. But throughout all of this, and you've brought us halfway there already, this book has a really clear central argument, which has to do with deforestation and China's own forms of forest oversight, and in turn, with how China's environmental history, at least it pertains to trees, at least, has been told. So I wonder if you could talk about this directly, Ian. You've already talked about Mark Elvin, but building on that, what does the field of China's environmental history sort of currently look like? And where is this book, where do you see this book intervening and making an intervention?
So the way that I understand the field of Chinese environmental history is actually coming out of, I think a lot of it in the early generations was influenced by the late imperial Jingxi scholarship, the sort of practical learning. And so there are some topics in that come out a lot, especially related to borders and related to water conservancy, that have been at the core of Chinese environmental history since it became a self-conscious discipline. And I think that as Chinese environmental history is moving into a second or perhaps a third generation, there's a lot more attention being paid to some of the other concerns that we see in environmental history in other places. And so in particular, scholarship on animals, scholarship on forests, which is where my own intervention lies, and things like this. But also, there's been a move to better contextualize some of the detailed ways in which people are involved in sort of local and regional ecosystems and the transformation of landscapes in a way that goes beyond an analysis that's totally centered on the state, although that obviously comes up a lot. In my work. And so I think that my big intervention here was in thinking about forests. One of the things that is sort of fundamental to how they function ecologically is that they regrow. And so there was a tendency to sort of assume that when you have documentation of forests being cut, that was sort of the end of it, right? That was the end of the story. Or if you had documentation of a sort of wasted landscape where the trees were gone, that was the end of the story. But in addition to that, or complicating that picture, is the fact that trees regrow both through self-seeding processes, but also because wood is just such an important resource. Right, it's the principal building material. It's the principal fuel. Woods are a major source of famine foods and other secondary foods, of fodder for animals, of fertilizer, of a whole bunch of chemical inputs. And so, this is so important to pre-modern and, in fact, even to modern economies, that when the trees are gone, that's a big problem. And so, people had to find a way to continue to supply themselves with wood and other forest resources. And so what we see in China, like in other places, is that when there were fears of wood shortage, and in fact, fears of wood shortage tended to come on faster than actual critical wood shortage, people would step into that as either a governmental necessity to resupply, to restock the woods, or as a commercial opportunity to make money because there is, you know, a consistent or even rising demand for wood and wood products, but the supply is falling, which means that you can make a lot of money by planting trees or by finding other sources of wood products. And so thinking about that sort of through both, I guess, ecological dynamics and market dynamics was pretty key to the intervention that I wanted to make with this book.
Perfect. I think you also touch on, and I'll just pull this out here because this is something that struck me. You also talk about a little bit about the change in periodization that, you know, this the look that you have on China's forest history sort of brings to it. You sort of note that typically when Chinese history is periodized, tend to think in terms of dynastic, we tend to think dynastically, but you point out that this, you know, misses great continuations in the local administration of forests, and this relates back to your note about China's 19th century as well, right? You talk about the 19th century crisis being just one bookend, if you like, along with its 11th century crisis around wood as well. So, and then in the middle there, you talk about there being a remarkably consistent period of forest oversight and, you know, comparatively stable ecology, which again relates back to when you're talking about Mark Elvin's work, that this is a rather different way of seeing this period of time. But thank you very much for mentioning the interventions that you picked out as well. With that, then, does it make sense to talk about the 11th century and this particular moment of crisis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. The 11th century, or more broadly, I think the Song, is also a period that Elvin identifies as a turning point. I'm very influenced by his scholarship and his suggestion of this, but I think that my takeaway from this in reading a little bit more deeply into what was going on in the 11th century is that this was a crisis that led to a new system of governance rather than a crisis that led to this very, very long slope of degradation. So do you want me to go into some more detail on what was going on in the 11th century that I see as bringing on this crisis?
Yeah, sure. I mean, why don't I touch on a little bit here what you sort of lay out in the book, just in terms of the shift from regulated abundance to this scarcity, right? So this really comes into the first chapter of the book, when you talk about how from the period of antiquity up until the 8th century, there is this idea both borne out in the actual trees themselves, but one of regulated abundance. And you talk about how people seem to be prevented from over-harvesting due to this sort of endless natural bounty. And then in the Song, there is a real concern, a real shift. And the solutions that people gravitate towards, solutions turned to by both the Song state and private entrepreneurs, are logging into new frontiers. And then the second, intensifying forest management, which leads to the planting of trees. And here you mean specifically the planting of trees for timber, not just fruit trees. And so this, I wonder then with that, if you want to talk about this shift. And what I'm really curious about actually here is what this shift meant in terms of how people looked at and wrote about trees. Where does this sort of play out in how people are thinking about trees and forests?
So I guess there are a few ways that we can see this shift emerging. And the first is this sort of discourse surrounding shortages or anticipated shortages. And I think the second is that there's a movement away from thinking about forests as basically these sort of loosely defined spaces full of trees to thinking about them in more territorial terms. And initially, I think that there's actually some confusion over what exactly these new sort of territorialized definitions are going to look like. But what we see concretely is that there's a move from the forests as being in this loose category of sort of mountains and marshes, the Shanze, which are these sort of common pool resources, and which imply some degree of common access, but also of very loose state oversight, to thinking about forests as bounded, I think first as bounded space and then eventually as property. And this transition really hinges, I think, on an understanding of the labor inputs. So in Tang law, forests are common pool resources, but the trees that you cut down, the timber that you cut down, are your property. And so there's a way in which in around the 11th, 12th centuries, because the labor inputs move from simply logging to, in many cases, also planting trees, there's now an implicit and in some cases increasingly explicit understanding that it's not just felled timber that can be treated as property, but there's also that, you know, the trees that you planted are your property. There's another field in which we see a little bit of this transition in how people are thinking and talking about trees, which has to do, and this doesn't fully come on until a little bit later, but there's a little bit of the mystique around forests is gradually lost. So these, you know, forests and woodlands move from being these sort of wild, untamed spaces that are, you know, homes for spirits and ghosts and gods and things like that, to being more tangible property, and therefore part of the more profane realm of commercial transactions, rather than this more abstract and sacred realm. I don't know if that gets to your question exactly.
No, I think it definitely does. I love thinking about the second part of what you said, though, about the shift. The shift from trees as being, you know, forests as being, you know, a place of spirits and the unknown, to being then something that is, you know, knowable and the result of, I guess, human planting then, right? I guess would also be involved in that sort of shift from the wild forest to something that is actually man-made. Am I right?
Absolutely,
in
absolutely.
That?
And so it goes from being something where a lot of the forces are not provided by humans to one where, you know, there are human inputs and human influences, you know, through the entire life cycle of the trees. And so they become very familiar and very tied up in the routine, rather than having this mystique as something that's both sort of spatially outside the the area with human settlement, but also is governed by forces that are outside of human control.
Perfect. I love that you said that, you know, they move to being something that's tied up in the routine, because of course trees then also become something that is tied up in not just routine, but in paperwork and in bureaucracies and in law. And this is really where The next part of the book sort of takes over. And chapters 2, 3, 4 really look at what happens once trees become tied up in all of this routine, once trees become investments. So I'll just touch on a couple of the things that these chapters talk about. So chapter 2, for example, boundaries, taxes, and property rights, looks at the institutional framework that was built to support commercial timber plantations, because, of course, without all this routine, without the state conducting surveys and centralized record keeping and formalizing laws that treated forests as property, landowners would have had no incentive to plant trees. Chapter 3, Hunting Households and Sojourner Families, looks at how the state regulated forest labor and how this relates to labor levies. And one, I suppose, important thing to note here is that in the 15th century, officials began to substitute in-kind levies of goods and labor for cash payments, you know, a move that's related to an influx of silver into China and empire-wide tax reforms. And this, you know, in terms of what it means for trees, then means that the state comes to intervene even less in how people, especially those on wooded fringes, manage their forests, and in turn led to a proliferation of different forms of contractual subordination when it comes to forest management, which you go on to explore in chapter four, deeds, shares, and pettifoggers. And this part of the book, among other things, looks at deeds and contracts as they pertain to forests. And one thing I just want to flag here that this chapter makes abundantly clear, at least to me, was that forest management was incredibly complicated, made even more so because of the, you know, slow multi-decade growth periods. So you talk about some of the really complicated contracts that spelled things out, like highly, highly divided plot ownership of some of these forests. You know, you mentioned plots split into like 700 some shares, or even on the low end, 200 something shares of that these plots are divided into. So very complicated papers and paperwork involved here. And there's a lot going on in these, in this part of the book, and I've only just plucked out a couple of the bare highlights. But rather than ask you to talk about the complications of forest tax, I wonder if you might talk about some of the sources that you draw on for this part of the book, or in the book on the whole, because you do also have an appendix in the book that talks about some of the sources and the digital methods that you used in creating this book. So I wonder if there's anything you want to talk about with that, and even if it does pertain to these chapters in particular on the topic of sources.
Sure. So these three chapters that you just summarized beautifully, better than I could, in fact, they mostly rely on sources from gazetteers and from deeds and contracts, and most of the deeds, in fact, are from Huizhou Prefecture. And the way that I was able to find these, I think, is a little bit unusual. I don't know. So any project that we do as historians, we have to find some sort of unifying subject of study that we then trace through the archives. And frequently that's a person or a group of people, or it's a place, or it's an event. And so what I realized I was going to have to do for this project is basically follow a tree. And that tree is, you know, the China fir, Cunningham lanceolata, Shanmu or Shamu in Chinese. And so the thing that really helped me out here is that there's now a large and still growing corpus of digitized sources. And it turns out that doing a character search for Shan or Sha is very, very productive, because it's fairly specific. A lot of the times when you when you're trying to figure out a search term, you end up with either only a fraction of the things that you want. So it's not general enough. It's not capturing everything that you want, or you end up with a whole bunch of stuff that you don't want. It's too general. It's too broad. But this tree name actually turned out to be quite specific, and to bring me into a whole bunch of places, some of which I anticipated ending up. I love nerding out over the single whip reforms. These are the reforms that sort of transformed the labor service by substituting silver for a lot of goods or in-kind labor. So I sort of knew that I was going to end up there, but it ended up taking me down a whole bunch of other places that I did not necessarily anticipate finding. One of which actually brings me into the next few chapters of the book, which were on the tariff system. I don't know, maybe you want to talk about that later, but basically I knew nothing about this tariff system until Fur kept popping up in these sections on tariffs across all these different gazetteers and a bunch of other sources like the Ming Huidian and things like that. And so this this search term for this tree actually brought me down a lot of really interesting avenues, and in some ways I'm giving away my dirty secret here, but it tells the story of the book, or at least the research behind the book. And I think actually something that I haven't had enough time to look into in more detail, but it actually says something about the tradition of botanical knowledge making in China, that this term is so consistent and so specific. And so that's something that I think is worth a little bit more thought and study. And so that is what helped me sort of cover a lot of the tax materials. And I actually, while I was in Berlin at Max Planck, I spent a lot of time extracting tax data from the gazetteers with just, you know, banking characters swimming before my eyes. I literally used to fall asleep and see banking characters behind my closed eyelids. It allowed me to really trace a lot of the movement of materials and movement of finances through, especially the Ming fiscal system. The Yuan and Song gazetteers are also interesting, are fascinating in another way, because they're still sort of figuring out how to consolidate this record keeping, and so it's a lot messier and harder to figure out. But then it also, I realized, and I was initially very resistant to this, but I realized I was going to have to dive into the contractual records to get the other side of this picture, because the picture given by the tax records is really incredibly superficial. All that the Song, Yuan, and Ming states really cared about was that these properties were registered and that they paid the tax. And the land tax on forests was generally, although not always, relatively low. And so I don't think that they cared that much about them. But the people who owned the forests and the people who worked the forests obviously therefore had to figure out the other side of the management picture. And so I spent, I don't know how many months just reading hundreds and hundreds of very, very formulaic land deeds. And that was a really interesting experience and an interesting lesson, because one of my takeaways from that is that even though it was very complicated, so forestry brings a whole bunch of complications that you don't see in other land markets, which, as I think we know, in late imperial China, land markets are already complicated enough as it is, because you have, the skin rights and the subsoil rights, or the surface rights and the subsoil rights are separated, and there's different layers of tenancy and stuff like that. And you have all of that in forests, but you have the additional complication of almost everything being divided into shares, some of which are like almost infinitesimal fractions. And then the fact that it takes, under ideal conditions, about 25 to 30 years for the investment to mature. But despite these complications, most of the deeds are incredibly brief, which suggests that to the people working them, these details were so banal and so just everyday that they didn't really need to note them. And what it also meant is that I really did need to pay attention to what they were noting, because if they were writing it down, it meant it was important. And I don't think it just meant that it was important. It meant that it was important to have written down, which in particular tended to mean things that had to do with land title and claims to land title and with claims on the investments when the trees matured. So I think I maybe went into too much of those details, but I think that that's actually where the real heart of this story is these people on the ground trying to figure out how they are going to deal with the novel risks as well as the substantial profits that they could attain from working forests, especially timber forests. And as you mentioned a minute ago, because the state was so removed from oversight, I think it was quite removed from land oversight from pretty much the 12th century, aside from basic land registration details or disputes that made it into the courts. And after the single whip reforms, it was actually quite removed from labor oversight as well. And so that meant that all these details had to be worked out contractually between the parties that were working the forests.
You said that you think that that it's sort of the heart of this, right? These fine details. And I think that definitely comes through in the book itself with all the details about these regulations and the laws that go, all of that detail, that fine detail, which, as you said, definitely mattered quite a bit to the people involved, right? Those who owned a very, very, very small portion of some of the forests are that you're looking at, and you know that were prepared to wait 25 years for a return on their investment. That's one of my parts of the book that I definitely enjoyed the most, and I definitely think that it should be taken as sort of clearly. You know, a moment where you'd clearly know that you've made it when you're falling asleep and banking characters are on the back of your eyelids in Berlin. That's clearly got to be the new mark of this is when you know that you're doing research.
You know, I think it takes a certain sort of historian. I mean, I realized that like the things that I study, like these incredibly routine like deeds and low level regulations and stuff like that is something that like if I encountered it in my day-to-day life, I would find to just be in enormous pain. But when I find it in my research, like my eyes light up and it's just like, yes, this is what I want to spend the next 12 hours on. You know, it's
Yes. Do you personally want to fill out the contracts about, you know, I don't know, owning some very, 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 very infinitesimally small share of a forest in your actual life? Maybe not so much, but working through those contracts in the Ming, I guess it would be an entirely different situation.
Well, and but one of the things that we can see is that, you know, what I think one of the reasons, to some degree, this argument comes from some things that Joseph McDermott figured out in his book. But these are clearly abstract investments by the point that you're investing in a 1/200th share of a forest. And so what that means is that most of the people who own those very small fractional shares own shares in a whole bunch of different properties. And that makes sense as a risk management strategy. It also makes sense because, you know, there was not like a stock market back then where when you need your money, you just sell a few shares of, you know, your 401k or whatever. When you need money and the trees are still young, there's nothing you can do about it, except that they found a way to do something about it by being able to cash out those shares early or by investing in properties where the trees would mature at different times. And so I think it was just, I mean, it's really, really fascinating. And it makes a huge amount of sense that this type of futures market would develop in this particular arena because it's precisely what was needed to manage these investments that don't mature for such a long time. But, you know, going back to what you were saying before, it's the type of thing that in my day-to-day life, I don't want to manage that. And so you have to figure that there must have been people who were specializing in managing the financial aspects of this, who were not necessarily the same people planting the trees. Like certainly by the time you get to around the 1560s, certainly by 1600, this is just too complicated. And it's so far removed from this actual business of like afforestation or logging or what have you.
Mm-hmm. So with that thing, you know, thinking about things that you might not want to engage with in your day-to-day life, or that you certainly don't engage with in your day-to-day life, why don't we move to talking about tariffs? So sick way to bring us into the next part of the book, chapters 5 and 6. And these two chapters, I'll just outline this a little bit. These, as a unit, look at the connection between wood markets and maritime activity. And these are, you know, on their own terms, fascinating chapters. And I can imagine that chapter 6 is going to be of particular interest to people, which looks at Chinese maritime exploits. But uniquely, and this goes kind of back to what you were saying much, much earlier about embedding, you know, specific moments in their context, this section of the book embeds Chinese maritime exploits into their material and institutional constraints. And also, I think a little bit uniquely, argues that Ming shipbuilding appears to have been quite sustainable. And I should also note that these chapters are where the comparative element is particularly strong, I guess. It comes through a little bit more, especially when you touch on how Chinese sea power and, you know, fleet construction compared to that of other powers. So there's a lot in the maritime, you know, the more explicitly maritime chapter. But you flagged tariffs as something that you were particularly interested in because, as you said, you knew nothing about it going in. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you found out about tariffs then in thinking about this part of the book.
So this is, like I said, this is not even something that I was looking for. And what I found is that tariffs on timber in particular, timber and other bulky materials, are this point of just incredible continuity. I think they start something like in the late 8th century, the 9th century, something like that, in the wake of the An Lushan rebellions, although I'm not entirely sure how they worked in the late Tang. But by the Song, and by like the very founding of the Song, this is a major source of timber and other structural materials. And it continues to be a major source of structural materials all the way through the Yuan, all the way through the Ming, and well into the Qing, which is not, you know, at the core of my book. But Meng Zhang has done some really great work on that. And they can, you know, the timber tariffs absolutely continue into the 18th and I think believe the 19th centuries as well. And so this was just astonishing to me because it was something that I knew not very much about. But the thing that was really cool to find out is that the different states use these tariffs in somewhat different ways. So the Song was actually very, especially the Southern Song, was very clever about adjusting the tariff rates to encourage imports at times when rebuilding was needed. So basically to encourage merchants to flood the market with cheap timber after fires or things like that. But to raise revenue at other times. In the Ming, the tariff levels were actually quite low on timber, especially on fir timber. But they were largely intended as a more or less direct supply of building timber for the shipyards. And there is this really, really fascinating nexus that develops, especially around Nanjing, where the shipyards and the tariff bureau are communicating with each other to share standards for timber sizes and things like this. And it's because the main use of the timber that was taxed at Nanjing, which is one of the major places where, you know, timber was offloaded from the Yangtze River interior, was to go directly into the shipbuilding projects. And this was just really, really interesting to me because the story that we have from Europe in particular is that the need to find shipbuilding timber was precisely what drove a number of European states into territorial forestry, that is, into controlling forests directly and governing the production of trees and timber. with Venice being a particularly early case of this. But this is what's behind, the famous ordinances on water and forests by Jean-Baptiste Colbert in France. There's a substantial program in Spain. This is what sends British surveyors into North America to draw the King's Broad Arrow on white pine trees, is to supply the Navy. But the Chinese states are not doing that because they don't need to. There are, a few exceptional periods when there is some state-directed logging going on, especially for mass timber, as I understand it. But for the most part, they are able to derive enough timber either directly from the tariff or from purchasing merchant timber using tariff revenue from other goods that the shipyards and the need for timber for the shipyards did not drive the Song or Ming states to do substantial forest surveys or focus on claiming particular species of trees or anything like that. And I intentionally left out the Yuan because it really is something of an exception. But especially during the reign of Kublai Khan, and the reign of the Emperor Yongle is another exception. There clearly was some state-supervised logging being done to build the famous treasure ships and the other ships in the South Seas fleets. But, more generally speaking, compared to the European context, they just did not have to invest very much energy into territorial forestry because the commercial forestry markets were so productive that they could basically just sit on the river and wait for the log rafts to come. And that was just astounding to me. And I think a really interesting point of comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. To go back to sort of what we were talking about right in the beginning about these, about this, again, this book is not a comparison throughout, but it definitely has these really useful and illuminating moments, I think, of comparison. And this is definitely a part of the book that does that and has those moments. So you mentioned there, in thinking about imperial logging and, in when it comes to these chapters, the need, the absence of a need to do it, as you said, they could just sit on the river and wait for the rafts, I guess, the barges to come up. And this is slightly different, at least there's a slightly different focus then when we come to the last part of the book, Beijing Palaces and the End of Empire. And this chapter, unlike with the shipbuilding, this chapter looks at the greatest pressure placed on the logging frontier, which is architecture. So much of this chapter looks at the acquisition of timber and the need for timber for the construction and then reconstruction of Beijing, a project that, and as you say in the book, led to the last and greatest official logging operations in South China, a project that spelled the final decline of old growth woodlands. And this part of the book covers three booms in imperial logging, one in the late 1400s, the mid to late 1500s, and the late 1600s, after which, or at least from the early 1500s onwards, officials start to note that the hills are looking a little bare and lumber teams have to push deeper into the mountains to find poles and beams and wood trees of sufficient size. So there's definitely the beginnings of a decline in timber yields, if not total deforestation. And this is probably my favorite singular chapter of the book, in part because you just have some fabulous descriptions of the difficulty of getting logs from the south. You have sections from woodblock illustrations of this process. And you mention a bus station that is still named Imperial Lumber Depot, which I think was just too fabulous a detail for me not to mention. And through all of this, that because you're talking about logging on the frontier, the edge of the Ming Empire really here, so you talk about native officials and non-Han logging teams. So I'm wondering if you could talk actually about this directly, because here really we see the intersection of fur and empire, the two cores of the title. So what is actually really meaningful about this intersection of the trees and the empire here? How is the fact that they're on the edge of empire shape the imperial logging projects as you see them in this part of the book?
So the way that I understand it, really the only reason that the Ming needed to involve itself in these logging projects was because they had a demand, a very particular demand for these incredibly large timbers, which were used in palace construction. And I just have to say, you know, if you want to read a really interesting look at the architectural side of this, I have to give a shout out to Aurelia Campbell's new book, What the Emperor Built. Aurelia and I actually worked on this a little bit together when we were at Max Planck. And but it's this very particular need. And so it's precisely the trends that I describe in the rest of the book that lead to the production of commodity timber, which is of a certain size, that means that most of the rest of the empire does not have these massive trees that are needed for pillars and beams. And so, like you said, the only place that they are able to find it is on the margins of where Ming control actually reaches. And one of the fascinating things about this area is that there was this very long-term, fairly explicit understanding that Han loggers would not go into the mountains in the southwest. In fact, in the Song, there was briefly actually a period when there was a chain stretched across the river. And so the non-Han loggers were not supposed to go below the chain. They, you know, they would float their logs down and they would be stopped by the chain, and the Han merchants were not supposed to go above it. And so what this had done is it preserved for hundreds of years these old growth forests, which had trees that were big enough for the imperial project. But because they're in this place where, you know, the sinews of imperial power are stretched to their limits, it was just incredibly difficult in a number of ways. You know, there are relatively few records from the Yongle period, which is when there must have been hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these massive timbers cut, principally from Sichuan, from southern Sichuan. But when officials returned to the region in the 16th century, because of a series of fires that meant that they needed to rebuild the palaces, they just found every aspect of the project difficult. Negotiations with, I mean, it was just unbelievable what they were doing to rebuild these stupid buildings. It's just like, they ran short of food. They ran short of money. There are these sayings that, like, I don't know how exaggerated they are, but like half of the workers who go into the hills die. Everybody's getting malaria. They're being attacked by non-Han tribes. Again, I suspect some exaggeration, but there are even pictures of them like being attacked by snakes and tigers. And even when there were not these extraordinary circumstances, you know, attacks or disease or starvation or what have you, even when the supplies arrived and the money arrived on time, it was incredibly difficult because the easiest, the most accessible trees had already been cut in earlier periods, and they don't just reappear on demand, right? These giant timbers didn't grow in 30 years or 40 or 50 years like commodity timber grown in the rest of South China. It would take hundreds of years for them to reach these dimensions. And so it's only deep in the mountains that they were able to find these. And so there were just enormous engineering difficulties on top of everything else. They had to build slip roads. There are these giant capstans used to haul logs up slopes. They built these temporary bridges called flying bridges to transport them across gorges. Then they had to float them down through rapids. And then, I mean, the really astonishing thing is that something like 80 or 90% of the trees that they cut, at least according to some of these sources, were not suitable for construction purposes. And I mean, it's just unbelievable. But the level of detail here is also because this is the one place where the Ming bureaucracy is really deeply and heavily involved in territorial forestry, in finding trees, in mapping where they are, in figuring out how to get them from where they're growing to the waterways where they can be floated. Oh, the other thing is that the trees are so heavy is that they have to attach hundreds of poles of bamboo just to for buoyancy. Just the level of engineering problems they had to overcome to get these trees out of the gorges of southern Sichuan and northern Guizhou is just unbelievable. And then on top of things, there was this really interesting gift economy, it's sort of framed as a gift economy, where the native officials of the region would present timber to the emperor, and then the emperor would gift them with robes and other stuff, right? And so it's sort of like framed through this language of the tribute system, but it's actually clear if you look deep enough into the documents that they're basically selling these giant timber, because there's a lot of both money and prestige that can be obtained from this. And they clearly cared enormously about the prestige bit as well. It's this coveted, it's often translated as the flying fish robe, but I think it's actually more like a dragon. If you look at the pictures of it, but they're just, these native officials are just falling over themselves and I think literally fighting with each other to get these last accessible stands of old growth timber so that they can get this really cool robe that shows that they're the most important official in the Southwest, right? They're the most important ruler in the Southwest. There's not a smoking gun for this, but I suspect that that this competition over these last major stands of old growth was behind some of these wars between the native officials in this region, and including the Bozhou Rebellion, which leads to this massive suppression on the part of the Ming. I learned somewhere that there were actually like Japanese samurai who had been captured during the Imjin War who were sent to suppress the Bozhou Rebellion, which is just a fascinating detail that I somehow didn't manage, I don't think, to put in the book, and I should have. But this war, this Bozhou Rebellion, seems to be at least in part over the competing claims to these last stands of old growth timber. And the ability to present them to the Ming state in exchange for substantial amounts of cash, and as well as this sort of claim to fame as the Da Ming Ding Ding of the Southwest.
I don't remember that detail from the book, but I will go back, and if it is in there, Ian, I will find it, because that's a fabulous detail. If it didn't make it in
the second edition, maybe.
I will look for it in the second edition when that gets put in. But I think all of what you sort of, the picture you sort of painted there, just really does build a picture of the incredible amount of prestige that was associated with this, right? Even, as you said, the wars were fought over it, even after all of the actual engineering difficulties of getting these huge trees out of where they were, after all of that, or on top of all of that, having to fight, go to war, to jostle even over the ability to present them, is a fascinating story. And I feel very justified in my, declaration that this is probably my favorite chapter of the book. But now that we're sort of here with this chapter of the book, we're at the end of the book, and also at the end of our conversation. So with this, Ian, thank you so much for, talking about, for writing the book, and first of all, for spending all of those hours falling asleep in Berlin with the characters on the back of your eyelids, all of that. Then writing the book and talking to me about it. But Ian, now that you're finished with our conversation and this book, as well. What are you working on next? What is inspiring you now? In addition to writing the second edition, where the story, as you said, of the samurai will be there, yes, in, front and foremost, yes, of course.
I think the first thing on my plate is probably to return to this story of lineage and environmental history. And, one of the things that I was getting at in my dissertation is that, aside from all these high-level institutions, at the very local level, it is largely lineage organizations that are making decisions about how to intervene in the landscape. And this is because, of the ownership through lineage trusts of large amounts of farmland and forest land, but it's also in large part through lineage rules and the use of litigation to protect lineage rights to things like grave sites and temples, and the development of more clearly articulated rules for who has access to these common pool resources. And so, one of the stories that I think is told, that I think I tell in Far and Empire, is really a story about the enclosure of the commons. So there were these forests that were common pool resources, and they're increasingly privatized. They're increasingly controlled by individual landlords. So how are some of these resources maintained as common pool resources, and how are some of them maintained as sort of protected lands? So that is probably the next thing that that I'm going to put a lot of time and thought into. The other thing that I am just obsessed with at the moment is some of the broader implications of gift exchange through what's sometimes called the tribute system. I think that's now increasingly considered a problematic term for it. And there's been some really interesting work on this, a lot of really interesting work on this. But one of the key things to me is that this is at its heart a material exchange. And so I'm interested in exploring some of the broader implications of this, especially in the Southwest, but also in some of these other areas, ringing the empire, and thinking a little bit more about what happens in these exchanges across these barriers that have been very intentionally erected between different ecological zones, between different ethnic groups, and between different forms of rulership and stuff like that. So that's a longer term thing that I'm thinking about.
I think those both sound like fascinating projects to, direct all of your time and attention to now. So very much look forward to, hearing and reading more about both of those. In the future, they sound like great, I can definitely see the continuations, or the offshoot makes it sound like they're somehow derivative, and that's not what I mean. I mean continuations of off from this project in particular. So best of luck with those. Again, very much looking forward to reading and hearing more about them in the future. And thank you again so much, Ian, for taking the time to talk about this project and this work with me today.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sarah. It's really been a lot of fun. And thanks for having me on the podcast.